This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us for hour number two of the program. Harriet Williamson is the producer at the controls, Jason Croft, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Many living things, from humans to bacteria, have ways of keeping track of time, and they do not need watches to do it. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking with a scholar, researcher here from University of Illinois. Martha Gillette is her name. And we'll be talking about some of the research that she and others here at the university have been doing on the neurobiology of time. She is interested in the master clock of the brain, and we all have one tucked into our brains that keeps track of time. She's interested in how that works, how it regulates body functions, and also how some disorders, things like sleep problems, mood problems, even neural breakdown problems, things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, can all be related to problems with the brain's internal clock. This is research she has been doing here at University of Illinois for a number of years. And for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you might like to, in addition to listening here this morning, you might like to attend a talk that she will be giving about the research that she has done. This is the Center for Advanced Study 21st Annual Lecture. This will take place tomorrow, 7:30 in the evening, at the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. And anyone who is interested should feel welcome to attend. She'll be talking on the topic, Adventures in Biological Timekeeping, the Clockwork of the Brain. She is here with us in the studio, and we're really pleased that she could be here and to talk and to take questions. She is, I hope I get this all right, she is professor in the departments of Cell and Developmental Biology and Molecular and Integrative Physiology, Colleges of Medicine and Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Neuroscience Program here at UIUC, and bioengineering. We get it all?
Yes, you did.
Okay, good. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And folks can send in questions by email if you'd like to do that. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I'm very pleased that you could be here and talk with us. And I'm sure that when people find out what it is that you do, they always have questions. They always want to talk. You know, they want to say, so why is it that at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I just fall asleep? These kinds of things, I'm sure that people always have questions, and that you have many, many great stories to tell about things that you and other people have learned about the biological clock.
The first question people usually ask me is, I'm going to Paris next week. Oh. How do I get on local time and not fall asleep when I'm visiting the Louvre the
jet
first
lag.
Day? Jet lag.
Yes, probably jet lag.
That is the most common question I get. And the whole process of jet lag is because you have a timekeeping system, which is organizing your physiology, your behavior, everything inside, and keeping it synchronized and in tune with day and night, which is the major variable in the outside world. We don't think about day and night as being a major variable, but it turns out it is the major organizer of what our bodies do inside.
Uh-huh.
And even now, we're starting to experience it as we go into the autumn. Night length gets longer, daytime gets shorter, our physiology changes, we may sleep a little more, we may feel more like eating chocolate as opposed to something like cheese for dessert. But lots of changes with the body, and all of these are governed by inputs to this clock.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm sure that anecdotally people would say, well, yes, they can tell that there is some connection between mood, their energy level, what they feel like mm-hmm. doing, that it has to do with time of the year. And certainly we know that there is this thing called seasonal affective disorder, that there
right.
are some people who have severe problems with depression when the days get shorter. So there is a real biological reason that those things happen.
Absolutely. And seasonal affective disorder is real. Some people, it varies with your genetic makeup. It's much more common as you go further north. Illinois is kind of in the middle, but if you're around the Great Lakes, state of Washington, you have a large percentage of your population who on a mood rating test will score as somewhat depressed, somewhat less energetic. Most of us feel a little bit not at our peak. And say in July at the beach, when the number of lux that is in the light in the environment hits you, you really feel on top of the world. I hear very few people who say November is their favorite month mood-wise.
I guess there are a few people, maybe this is much, much smaller, there are a few people who do experience a phenomenon like that in the summertime. But I guess by and large, if people are going to have mood issues related to that, it is that. It is short days, not enough light.
Right.
That's going to be an issue.
Right. And since we're talking about seasonal affective disorder, since we're getting into that time of the year, it is very effectively treated with morning light and morning light in the blue range, because the photoreceptors in your eye that feed into the timing system are simply interested in the presence of light, and they are blue light photoreceptors. Mm-hmm. And so some light, when you're reading the paper, you don't have to look at the light. You just have to experience the light so it's hitting your retina. And it can give your body a signal that day's a little longer, that it damps down melatonin, which is the signal of night in the body. So it's a very effective way of naturally treating this.
So artificial light does work.
Yes, it does work. Mm-hmm.
Do all living things have these kinds of internal clocks?
All living things that are above the bacterial level, but you said bacteria. There are some very low level, I should say, proteins that do have clocks too. But the thinking has been that if you had a body cycle that was less than 24 hours by many hours, how are you going to have a clock that kept 24-hour time? Because as you, like a bacteria may divide once every 4 to 6 hours, how are you going to cue in where in the 24 hours you are? But there are some organisms that are those early life forms that have clocks. It turns out they're photosensitive, and so they need to be able to respond to the presence of light. Probably the most organisms with clocks are the blue-green algae that live in the Pacific and form these hundreds of miles of mats of green that they rise up and down in the water column depending on whether light is there. And they're the major producer of oxygen in our environment.
Why 24 hours? Why is it a 24-hour clock?
That's a great question, and that's something that is debated often in the field. It turns out so the clock we're talking about is called a circadian. The break that down into the parts of the word. It's circa, which means around, and dia means day. So it's about 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So there are no natural organisms who are keeping solar time. Actually, that was one of the questions people asked. If it's really the sun cycle that's setting the clock or that's driving your behaviors, why isn't it exactly 24? Because that's what the sun is. Even if day is long and night is short, the sum of the two is 24. 0.00000. For animals that are put in a constant environment, or plants, because the first experiments were done on plants, and you make a record of over several days of something like their running behavior or the movements of the leaves on the plants, they're not exactly 24 hours. They're a little bit shorter or they're a little bit longer. And the interpretation of this is if you have this little bit of error signal, it's easier to adjust to alterations in the occurrence of light versus the occurrence of dark. And so it turns out you and I, David, are probably a little longer. If you, like I, like to stay up late at night, we're probably a little more than a little longer. And those people who call themselves larks and like to get up at 5 a.m., oftentimes when they're put in a constant environment and tested, their actual clock is running shorter than 24 hours. And so it's pulling them a little bit shorter each day. But the natural exposure to the outside world or artificial light will pull you onto a 24-hour cycle.
Yeah. My clock seems to be changing. I don't think I'm having anything to do with it. It's doing something on its own. Well, is there some relationship between aging and the internal clock?
There is. Your clock is changing all throughout your life. Hmm. So very young children, babies, they wake up and down, feeding at all different hours because the elements of their clock and the way it talks to their body systems haven't consolidated. Then early on, you get an established rest activity cycle and the other parts of physiology, which form themselves basically around 24 hours in coherent ways. So for people who are active in the daytime, their activity cycle is primarily when the light is out there in the world and they usually sleep at night. And then you have nocturnal organisms. As you age, however, the clock tends to desynchronize as far as the elements coming apart. And so you tend to see shorter bursts of rest and wakefulness. The fact that you see naps and age as people age is one piece of evidence of that. In the case of individuals who are diagnosed with one form of Alzheimer's dementia, and there are many forms, that's a sort of a very broad disorder, you find a certain group who have periods of rest and activity all throughout the 24-hour cycle, and they get to be difficult to care for because their caretakers cannot keep up with their rising and resting. Mm-hmm. And some of those individuals, after death, have been found to have degeneration of this central clock region in the brain.
Our guest in this hour focuses Martha Gillette. She is a Center for Advanced Study professor of cell and developmental biology, and she has attachments to a number of different departments on the campus. But she's a researcher who, for a number of years now, has been doing work on this very issue, that is, that the way that organisms, human beings, for example, and others keep track of time with these internal clocks that we have, things that are very important to regulating a lot of our behaviors. And she'll be giving a talk on this subject tomorrow night at 7:30 on the campus. You can attend that. And of course, here questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Can you identify, I know you can, the place in the brain where this clock lives?
We know exactly where it is, and this has come from several decades of studies on experimental animals. It's very hard to figure out in the beginning what in your head or your body is driving any sort of behavior. And as I often ask my students, if you're looking at activity in a wheel, which you do if you have a pet hamster, you give the hamster a wheel and let it run, and you then tie up the hamster's legs and you ask the hamster, is that telling you where the hamster's clock is? You'd have to say no, because the hamster can't give you an expression of the behavior. You're asking a question about the patterning or organization of behavior. So what you're looking for is something like those individuals who had some kind of damage to their brain. Mm-hmm. And what we now know is there's a very small part of the brain right above your hard palate. It's getting direct projections from your eye. And that's the part of the brain, if you damage it, you will have arrhythmicity in all of your behaviors and physiology. And this area is, again, named for its location, as many parts of the brain are. It's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Supra means above. Chiasmatic means it's simply above the place where the optic nerves come in and you get crossing over. So that's called the chiasm. Mm. And so it's sitting right there. It's at the base of the part of your brain that controls the things you do and don't think about it, like body temperature, eating, sleep and wakefulness, sexual behavior, hormone timing. So it's sitting there, and it actually times the occurrence of all of those behaviors, and then further out in the body, the physiology they control.
Mm-hmm. So it should, because because exposure to light is important to regulate this. So it shouldn't maybe be surprising that it's there intimately connected with your eyes and information that comes from your eyes. Although it's also true, though, that people have this roughly 24-hour clock that runs. That if you take people and you put them in a room where they never saw any light,
the clock still goes. There was an interesting set of experiments done in southern Germany by the early researchers trying to understand behavior, which is what we do. And they asked for volunteers to go down into the bunkers that were left after World War II, and not surprisingly, perhaps, graduate students volunteered. They took all their books and all their studies, and they went underground, and they lived there for weeks. And all they were asked to do was to chart when they went to bed, when they went to sleep, to take their body temperature at those times. And what they saw is they still saw a regular alternation of activity and rest, the peak and the trough of body temperature, as it was when they were out in the big wide world. But over a series of days, the time at which they got up was a little bit later each day, by about half an hour. So after 2 weeks, they were very changed with respect to their rest activity cycles versus what it was when they were seeing the light. And so what this is telling us is if you don't see a light at some point every 24 hours, it's called free running. You'll start to just move later and later and later. People who go to the South Pole tell me this is what they experience. They just work and work and work until they're tired, and then they get up. So they basically tend to run according to their natural endogenous clock a little bit longer every day.
Yeah. So I suppose that if you spent all of your life in a building, maybe that would be okay. But the problem is if you're an animal that is active when it's light, your rest cycle is when it's dark. You don't want to be suddenly up and really energetic at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's
exactly.
Just not going to work for you.
Exactly. And of course, there's a natural group of people who have this problem, and that's the profoundly blind. I was an advisor to the group at Oregon Health Sciences Center trying to find a natural stimulus that they could use in place of light. And that group developed a melatonin treatment that was given once each day and pulled those individuals into a regular 24-hour cycle. And that was very effective for them. Interestingly, there is a group of the blind who are entrained to the light-dark cycle, although they've never seen a shape, they don't see color or movement. If you give them a flash of light during what would be their rest cycle, so basically at night, and you look at their melatonin levels, and I should preface this by saying melatonin is the body's signal for night. It's the hormone of night in the world. Mm-hmm. But if light comes on at night, immediately you stop making melatonin. Those people stop making melatonin. So they had intact this special set of photoreceptors that's bringing information into the biological timing system.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So then what happened, you know, you talked about the fact that what happens is that in conjunction with light, the cycle light and dark, the timekeeping mechanism gets it sort of knows what time it is and wants to kind of line up with that depending on what's going on. But then what happens then is that the brain releases these chemicals that things like melatonin that then go on and do other sorts of things.
Right.
So depending on what it is your body decides you should be doing at that time, it's going to say, okay, time to go to sleep. Here's a little squirt of something that will mellow you out and make you relax. Or if it's time for you to be active, then there's going to be something else that's going to be happening.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. So another interesting manifestation of biological timekeeping is the sleep patterns. Mm-hmm. And this is actually the area in which – the second area that I get questions in. It's the reason – because the clock organizes sleep patterning. It's the reason the National Institutes of Health funds this area primarily, but it's not the only reason, is the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Because sleep disorders tend to be disorders that may involve breathing – and so on. But the story that I wanted to tell you was a group of people at the University of Utah who put out a call for individuals who thought they had sleep problems and had persistent sleep problems that had been with them for a long, long time. And they got a number of people who called in, and they identified one particular woman who had a specific request. And she said, you know, I'm a grandmother now. My grandchildren are entering the university, and I just like them to have a better social life than I did. I always go to sleep at 7 o'clock at night, and my husband does too. We both are early birds. But, you know, I never really had much of a nightlife. I never had a lot of friends, and I'd like it to be different for my children. And so they brought the family in, and they did a pedigree of sleep disorders, and they found that there was an inheritance of this early to bed syndrome. And then they looked at some of the elements that keep time, and I haven't actually mentioned the fact that timekeeping is embedded in your genes, and there's specific genes dedicated to keeping time. So they looked at these clock genes in this family from near Salt Lake City, and they found they all had the same change in one of the genes. It was one of the core timekeeping elements which causes their clocks to run fast. And so they had the first inherited sleep disorder that was based in the most fundamental place you could have it, those core elements that keep time. And since then, they've found a number of human variants in these clock genes. There are a number of them. And so it happens that there are persistent changes that are embedded in your genes We don't have a way to fix those right now. All we can do is try to live a lifestyle that will help us have light at the right time, you know, keep our activities regular, and so on.
Hmm. But that's so it sounds as if what you're saying is, if we say we have one person who says, if left to my own devices, I would get up at dawn and I would go to bed when the sun went down. And then we have with somebody else who would say, well, if left to my own devices, I would probably stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning and sleep until 10 in the morning. And that would be, if I could just do what I would want, that's what I would do. In both of those cases, that's something that is genetically encoded?
It's starting to look like it is. It is genetically encoded that we have a natural propensity. So it isn't, you know, moral turpitude or something that you did wrong in your youth. But in fact, it's your natural physiology. It's the way your body aligns with the world because it's driven by this clock.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Martha Gillette. She's professor in the departments of cell and developmental biology and molecular and integrative physiology, the College of Medicine, Liberal Arts and Sciences, the neuroscience program, and bioengineering. And she is interested in this whole business of how the body keeps time. And she'll be talking about this in a talk tomorrow night on the campus, Adventures in Biological Timekeeping, the Clockwork of the Brain. And we are happy to have you here. And we have a couple of people. In fact, we have a whole bunch of people now who have questions. And we're happy to take them. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we will start with Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you mentioned the German experiments during the Second War, because I wondered why the U.S. was doing the same type of experiments on this hemisphere at about the same time. I really don't expect you to make a comment on that, but the thing really worth describing, if you can, is why is it that all creatures that we use as work or companion animals or whatever, if they were subjected to the same work rules and styles of living as what we have, would be considered victims, and Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals would be called in, and why we as upper echelon animals are allowed to wonderfully treat our poultry, our swine, our cattle in factory productions?
Well, I can't really comment on the generality of the way things are, you know, the core of what you're talking about. But what I can tell you is that all of the animals that we're talking about here, whether they're companion animals, work animals, corn plants, for heaven's sake, all of them have clocks that organize their behaviors, and it's certainly the best thing we can do is keep them in alignment with the light-dark cycle, because not to do so puts stresses on your body.
Well, do we? I guess that makes me ask a question like you say our companion animals, the ones that live in our homes with us, the most common ones, would they naturally be on a different cycle than we are, and are we somehow interfering with their natural behaviors by trying to get them and their clocks aligned with ours?
Their clocks are pretty close to ours, so they're basically 24 hours. Each species has its own cycle. For instance, the best studied are rodents, and mice are shorter than 24 hours, as are hamsters, and rats are longer. Nobody really knows why their systems were organized that way, except that they were that way in nature. But what we probably would, the best way to treat companion animals would be to let them sleep at night, even though David and I and you like to stay up late at night. We like to turn on the light on the wall, which extends our active period. But that's basically not living close to nature. You know, living in complete tune with nature for all of us would be to go back to the farm or the cave and just go by the sun. But I don't think any of us are going to do that anymore. There's something very positive about the presence of light and extending the light into the night. Companion animals probably don't have that same thrill in staying up late at night. In fact, I noticed my dog is going to bed pretty early in the darkest room in the house.
Yeah, we have a cat like that too. When it starts to get late, he sits on his looks at you like, okay,
are we? It's time.
It's time. Come on, let's go. Let's go to bed. Fisher is the next caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah,
First of all, I really appreciate you sharing that differences in sleep pattern could possibly have genetic basis, because my husband and I are totally different. He gets up early, I stay up late, and it causes a lot of challenges. But I find that a lot of times in society, people say, oh, you can change it, just get up early, and it's not that easy. So I'm glad to know that it's not just me being difficult. It could be some kind of genetic basis.
Oh, good.
I'm very excited about that, and we'll check your website and look forward to learning more. I'm wondering, I heard them speak beginning that some of your work includes Parkinson's patients, and I've been looking on the website here about this area in the brain you were describing and see that it is in the hypothalamus. I'm wondering if this also sort of, if you do any work with ADHD people, because ADHD sometimes has a lot of impact on just a person's concept of time, not just the rising and sleeping part. But I'm just wondering if you do any work with that. I've always assumed that I stay up late because I'm not distracted by all the other things going on because nothing else is going on, when in fact it could just be my time clock. So I'm just wondering some of the other areas that can be affected by these time patterns, and whether or not it's the body causing the time problem and making it look like some kind of a disorder, or if it truly is some kind of a disorder.
Well, the first thing I need to clarify is I'm not a clinical researcher. I do basic research, but the basic research that we do has tremendous clinical relevance. Mm-hmm. And so what I should now actually come into an area I haven't brought up yet, and that is, although there's this central master clock in the brain, the news in this field over the last, say, 8 years is that all cells in the body have clocks. When this was first found, discovered, many of us were like, okay, it was one thing for fruit flies to have clocks in all cells in their body. It was one thing for maybe a plant, a flowering, like a morning glory, to have those clocks there. But humans would have clocks in all cells in their body. We know that we do. And this includes different parts of the brain. So we're now in a situation where the central clock, which is the only one that gets information about light and dark in the environment, needs to send a signal out to these follower clocks, these subsidiary clocks. You might call it the rest of the clocks in the clock orchestra, and it has to synchronize them so they work together and basically in tune with the information that central clock has about day and night. Now, with respect to these other disorders, there can be coupling defects that are, you know, minimize or in some way impede the synchronizing signal from the central clock to the other parts of the brain or the body. That's another new area that we're starting to work with the Jonathan Swiedler's lab here in chemistry. What are some of those cues within the brain to other parts of the brain? So this is kind of a new area, an area in which we're just starting to get insight on how the clock synchronizes everything. As far as your own personal behavior, you know, what works well for you and keeps you feeling productive and alert is probably the best way to live.
Thank you. Then I'll say I have your seal of approval for staying up late.
Thank you very much for the call. We have a couple of other people here. We'll get to them in just a moment. Of course, continue to talk with our guest, Martha Gillette, after a short break. This is Focus.
After 35 years as a Supreme Court Justice, John Paul Stevens retired last year. Now he's written a new memoir. We'll talk with him on the next Fresh Air. We'll also talk with Colson Whitehead about his new novel, Zone One, a post-apocalyptic story set in Manhattan after a plague left the city overrun with zombies. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose 21st annual lecture is Adventures in Biological Timekeeping by Center for Advanced Study Professor Martha Gillette on Thursday, October 20th at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are on here Monday through Friday, 10 until noon, 10 different topics. Mix it up. We try to mix it up and have a lot of different things on the show. Tomorrow morning, in the 10 o'clock hour, we will take your questions on prescription medicine. That's something that we do occasionally on the show. Our guest will be Dr. James Rybacki. He is a pharmacist, editor of the newsletter, The Essential Guide to Medical News. He's president of the Medicine Information Institute. So he knows a lot about prescription medicines and what they do. So we'll have general questions, but we'll also have a particular topic that we want to talk about, and that is osteoporosis. And for some of the program, in addition to Dr. Rybacki, we will have as our guest Mary Bucksign. She is an assistant professor at the Harvard Med School, and this is a subject she's particularly interested in. So that's tomorrow at 10. And then in 11 o'clock hour, you'll hear an interview. This was a recorded interview that Jim Meadows, part of our news staff, host of Morning Edition, did last week with Don Gagne. He's an award-winning national political correspondent for National Public Radio. He was visiting here in the area, and Jim sat down with Don in the studio and spent some time talking about politics and political reporting, and we recorded it, and you can hear that tomorrow at 11. You can check up on the schedule, listen to past programs by going to the website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of the show, we are talking with Martha Gillette. She's professor of cell and developmental biology at the University of Illinois. And as you just heard, she's going to be giving this talk about the work that she's done, Adventures in Biological Timekeeping. That's tomorrow night at 7:30 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. And anybody who would like to hear her should feel welcome to stop by. We have some other questions here, too, and questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. Good. Anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Back to the phones. I have somebody calling from Terre Haute in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Earlier, you were talking about blue light, and I was wondering, what are some good artificial sources of blue light? And I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
Ooh, a little feedback there. Yes, go ahead.
So natural light, that is sunlight, and natural light bulbs have light in the blue range. There are lights that are sold in medical supply establishments or online that actually have more of the spectrum of light. Just for using with seasonal depression. And to be honest, people in my research lab have thought of putting those in their little research rooms to give them a little more energy in the wintertime, too, because they all feel they're a little bit less productive in the winter. So this is not something that just pertains to those who feel deeply depressed, but it certainly does pertain to them. And sitting by the sun, this light in the morning, there's been a lot of debate, but it's now well established that it's the morning light that's the most effective at talking to your clock and saying, hey, morning's come, it's a little brighter than it really is in the outside world, and get your melatonin levels down. So yeah, there are a number of different sources, but natural light is a great one.
Okay. Yeah, well, hope that helps. Next, we'll talk with somebody who is, I believe, on the road on our line number 3 here, somewhere on I-57. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, hi.
I haven't been able to hear all of the show, and so if this is a topic you've already discussed, please just say so, and I'll just catch it on the podcast. But I'm curious as to when our biological sets, your biological clocks get triggered. You know, I mean, is it something that in utero that there's enough change in the light that, you know, a fetus can pick it up, or from the mother's chemical changes, or is there actually something upon being born that brings about, triggers the clock?
That is a great question, and that's a question that was really one of the first ones people asked, is when does your clock get started? In mammals, like you and I, it happens in utero. It happens due to chemicals from the mom, although light can get through the skin. Some light can get through the skin, but it's very well established that your mother sets your clock. These experiments were done by cross-fostering very young animals to another mom from another lighting cycle, and what they did was the new mother's signals were able, if there's no other cue, were able to pull them into the new mother's lighting cycle. So it's very well established. In some organisms, and I believe it's chickens, something where, you know, you're not in your mom's tummy, you're in a hard eggshell, they have to see light to get their clock ticking. That's my understanding of that area. But for you and I, for mammals, it's a chemical from our mother's blood. Melatonin is one of those chemicals. It's not just one, because people remove various glands trying to figure out what is the signal. And it turns out most biological systems have a lot of built-in redundancy. You don't rely on only one signal for a very important cue. And so prenatally, it's many kinds of signals that come from mom across the placenta.
Well, suppose that a mother then has something dysfunctional about her biological clock, her circadian clock. Is that going to impact the infant's biological clock, circadian clock? And if it does, can that be corrected once the child is out and, you know, exposed to a 24-hour cycle?
Well, certainly once you're on your own, you're going to be experiencing light on your own, and that's going to be the major determinant of how your intrinsic clock is synchronized to the natural world. As far as mothers and their problems, probably in a young woman, there aren't a lot of serious problems. However, shifting your time zone is one of those. You know, that's involves changing your clock over a series of days, and the fetus's clock would change with the mom's over that same period of time. No experiments have been done. I would presume it's not a big deal as long as it isn't happening regularly. It's not something, because it's a form of a stress to shift your clock.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I really hope I'm going to be able to make it up to Champaign tomorrow night.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We'll keep on going here. The next person we'll talk to is in Kankakee, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Taking my call. Sure. I missed a little bit of the program. I went inside for a while. I was wondering, I have a friend who works in a chemical factory that works swing shifts, 12 on, you know, for 3 days, off a couple days, then 12 on for nights the next 3 days, or a similar kind of a scenario where she flips back and forth between working 12-hour days and 12-hour nights. Has anybody ever done any studies as to what, other than automobile accidents, those people are going through with respect to their productivity, to their longevity, things like that? Has that had any effect on people over time?
There have been many studies in that area. OSHA, National Transportation Safety Board, all of them are very, very interested in things like hours of service, which relates to what you're talking about, and that is moving your active time into when you would naturally be sleeping. Shift workers are another, OSHA is very interested in that because it's a stress to your body and your acuity, your ability to pick up subtle changes in your environment diminishes if you're undergoing this series of shifts of your clock, because during that period, your body systems become desynchronized. They're not all in the same alignment they were before you shifted your clock, and they kind of wander around a little bit. Your liver will go one way, and your muscle systems may go another, but they come back together. Now, most of us can adjust to it. All of us do some shifting. However, prolonged shifts in cycles, like your friend who's doing the swing shifts, like airline pilots and staff do, it becomes a very difficult thing for them. There are studies emerging showing that, and this is only in research animals, that it can have a deleterious effect on your immune system, which is not surprising after all.
Yeah.
And the question is how long you can subject yourself to those kind of stresses. There are shift work cycles that are better than others, and those involve a gradual progression through the 24-hour cycle, so you end up back to where you started.
Yeah.
The difficulty that you experience when you're shifting on your work hours is you need to keep daylight out of what's going to be your inactive period, because otherwise your body's getting mixed signals. You're up and active. That gives your body a signal. It's my active zone, which would normally be daytime. And then when you want to go to rest, that should be when it's dark in the world. But if the light comes in, it's going to be one of those signals for change, and it's going to tell your clock, hey, I'm not aligned with day and night. I need to move things again. And so then you have two systems working against each other, the active period and the light signal. So that's what you really want to avoid. Room darkening, shades help, you know, keeping the sound down. It gets to be tough, though, when you want to interact with your family and, you know, go to birthday parties and have, you know, baseball practice and have a normal life with the rest of your family. So that's something you have to work with. But the best advice is to try to work with your natural's body cycle if you're a little longer, just to keep progressing later and later and later until you come around today. And I don't know how many companies are enlightened to that, but it certainly not only gives them a better level of productivity, but a healthier workforce.
Yeah, I would think that productivity would go down, number one. And number two, I just think that factories that work like that are trying to get two shifts out of one, you know, so that they have less employees. And to me, that's crazy, you know. That's why we have unemployment problems, or part of the reason why we have unemployment problems. Anyway, thank you very much.
Right. Sure.
Thank you. Well, I would certainly think that one of the big problems you'd get into there, and that, of course, this would be the reason that OSHA would be interested, was you'd get a lot, your rate of injury and accidents and all kinds of problems are going to go up if people are not really alert.
Absolutely. If you look at some of the major decisions that had catastrophic consequences, Three Mile Island, Exxon Valdez, all of them involved decisions that were made between 2 and 3 in the morning.
Really?
So, yeah.
I'll try to note that down, not make any important
decisions
between 2 and 3 in the morning. Let's go to Champaign for another caller, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is very exciting, and I have been able to understand the relationship between the gene pool or the DNA of all life forms that are animal life, in the sense that we have two eyes that are balanced on our heads and so forth, whether we're mice or people. Now, this is the first I've heard, though, that the gene pool of plants relates to ours in the sense of this clock, because if you're saying that corn or, of course, morning glories and so forth have genes that relate to time like ours can we identify in the plant world what those genes are, and are they in common as the DNA proteins are between plants and ourselves?
What a great question. Those genes have been identified, at least the first round. You know, the more we look, the more we see. They are not in the same lineage as ours. They're distinct sequences, but they act in a timekeeping oscillation like the ones in you and I. There are morning genes that turn the making of chlorophyll on before dawn in anticipation of the arrival of the sun. And that's one of the reasons that we think the clocks have become so deeply embedded in living things, is they allow you to anticipate changes in the natural world. So the chlorophyll-making genes are morning genes in plants. They cause the synthesis of chlorophyll before dawn, and that time changes over the course of the year. So their expression changes depending on when dawn has been the day before. The other set of clock genes in plants are called a class called TOC, T-O-C. Lots of clock genes have clocky names.
And is there a tick also?
There's a what?
Is there a tick?
No. I don't know about tick, but the TOC genes. And the TOC genes are fascinating because they are the ones that have to be expressed at the same time as pattern formation genes to get flower production. I heard one of the main researchers in this area, Steve Kay, who's at UC San Diego, talk about this a few years ago. And when they realized that you only get flowering when the TOC genes, the late day active genes, and these pattern formation genes are expressed at the same time. And that tells you that it has to be have something to do with the length of the light cycle. So they're co-expressed. And that's when you get flowering in plants. So the clock then is a determinant not only of your 24-hour responses to the natural world, but also to your responses as night length and day length change, as I said earlier. And this is especially important for plants, of course. So that's a great question. Thanks.
Oh, now, are there any other manifestations of our lives that we have in common with plants, like digestive systems and other things like that, besides our clock connection?
Well, not the digestive system, sorry.
Okay.
But there are many, you know, fundamental aspects like the contractile proteins in cells, some of the structural proteins. So some of the most fundamental building blocks, I'll put it that way.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much. We have about 5-6 minutes left here. We're talking in this hour of Focus with Martha Gillette. She's professor of cell and developmental biology at University of Illinois, and for some time now has been doing research on this subject, that is, how living things keep time. And questions are welcome. We'll try to do a few more in the time that remains. So we'll go to Seattle. Must be someone listening online. Line 2. Hello.
Hi. I hope this question is germane. If you find that your sleep patterns get interrupted by, you know, loud noise, whatever, neighbors in this case, other than trying to, you know, change the circumstances, what can you do when you find that you've been thrown out of whack? It's quiet, but you still, you know, can't go to sleep. There's like some sort of, I don't know, post-traumatic stress. Do you have any advice for that?
Okay. So with the sleep cycle, there is a period. Actually, I have a book called Wide Awake at 3 a.m., and that sort of summarizes the problem. There's a dip in your propensity to deep sleep in the middle of the night. And if that's the time you get a disturbance, it is harder to go back to sleep. How do you improve on that? I am not a believer in sleeping pills, because the kind of sleep you experience in that case is not a true sleep. It's a more of an inhibition of the brain's sleep systems. But this is related to clocks. What I can tell you is it's best to just keep your don't put the lights on, because that'll be a stimulus for the daytime. Oftentimes, some sort of white noise, because it's probably not only the loud neighbors, but things you've been worrying about in the daytime, loops in your brain that you just get stuck in, that you want to kind of get past so you can let the sleep processes put you over into this other state. I'm a great believer in milk and cookies, and they actually form a precursor to one of the main neurochemicals that helps you sleep. And so your mom was right.
Warm milk and cookies before you go to bed. Well, I hope that helps. Let us continue, and we'll go to Herrick, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm in the trucking industry, and the hours that we're allowed to work are basically all 11 working hours and 8 sleeping hours, which tends to mean that you're not on a 24-hour day. And I think people are reluctant to increase the working hours because they see, you know, see you becoming more tired and thus less safe. But I wonder if some combination there that you might know of is the perfect combination of time off, time working to keep you alert and still on a 24-hour schedule.
Well, you have the key there, and that is you want to stay as close to 24 hours as you can, because any other combination, when you get past 22 or 26, is really going to shift you in one direction or another, so you move away from 24 hours over the course of the day. I don't have a good piece of advice. I do know that studies have been done where I've seen these videos where they actually watch your eyes as you go into 2 or 3 in the morning if you're driving. And you go into these periods called microsleeps where your eyes are open, but you're not seeing anything. And you're not tracking changes in the environment. And so you want to avoid driving or actually doing anything that involves, you know, just life-threatening decisions at that time?
Well, it's well known that most of the major traffic accidents tend to happen at between 2 and 4. In fact, some of the trucking companies won't allow their trucks on the road during those times. But I kind of wondered how much more it takes out of you when you're driving at night versus driving in the daytime. And maybe there should be a compensation, something to the effect of you can drive 2 hours in the day or 1 hour at night type thing.
Interesting ideas, but you're right. You're absolutely right about those statistics.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, we'll try and do one more here. Caller's in Fithian, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Do sleep masks improve your sleep if your spouse insists on a nightlight?
Oh, sleep masks?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely, because they're going to keep the light out.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So dark at night is good.
Right.
For sleeping.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. We're almost out of time now. Maybe this can't be a short answer. How did you become interested in doing research on this subject?
Oh, that isn't a short answer.
It's not a short
answer. But, you know, with research, and this is because now I'm speaking as a scientist, you kind of are, if you can, follow your passion. Follow what you're really, really interested in. And I came here many years ago as a spouse, and the lab I was working in, which turned out to be my husband's lab, and I had some space there, I got the opportunity to work on this before people even realized it was important. Mm-hmm. Some of my colleagues had said, you know, Martha, why are you working in such a strange area? And over the intervening years, the compass has moved. So now we know the clocks are part of everybody's story, everybody's research, everybody's natural life. To live a long and happy life, it's best to be in tune with your clock and thereby the world.
Well, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you'd like to hear more from our guest, Martha Gillette, she's professor of cell and developmental biology at the University of Illinois. She'll be giving a talk. This is the Center for Advanced Study 21st Annual Lecture, Adventures in Biological Timekeeping, the Clockwork of the Brain, tomorrow night, 7:30 at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. Anybody who's interested can stop by. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Maybe this can't be a short answer. How did you become interested in doing research on this subject?
Oh, that isn't a short answer.
It's not a short answer.
But, you know, with research, and this is because now I'm speaking as a scientist, you kind of are, if you can, follow your passion. Follow what you're really, really interested in. And I came here many years ago as a spouse, and the lab I was working in, which turned out to be my husband's lab, and I had some space there, I got the opportunity to work on this before people even realized it was important. Mm-hmm. Some of my colleagues had said, you know, Martha, why are you working in such a strange area? And over the intervening years, the compass has moved. So now we know the clocks are part of everybody's story, everybody's research, everybody's natural life. To live a long and happy life, it's best to be in tune with your clock and thereby the world.
Well, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you'd like to hear more from our guest, Martha Gillette, she's professor of cell and developmental biology at the University of Illinois. She'll be giving a talk. This is the Center for Advanced Study 21st Annual Lecture, Adventures in Biological Timekeeping, the Clockwork of the Brain, tomorrow night, 7:30 at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on the campus. Anybody who's interested can stop by. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church
Almost
and Foundation.
I'm
a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at mckinley-church.org.
That's it for us this morning on Focus. We hope that you'll stick around, though. We'll have the afternoon magazine for you, and Jim Meadows will be sitting in as host today. He'll be along in a few minutes. But first, we'll get you started with an update on the commodity markets. And with the numbers, here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Dave. And good afternoon, everyone. As we're looking at the commodity markets and heading up into the 12 o'clock hour, we're seeing that European milling wheat futures little unchanged from Wednesday. Hesitant trade there, though. Lack of major news, leaving the market firmly in its recent trading ranges. Gains in U.S. wheat, though, here on the futures this morning in Chicago. Continuing hopes of a resolution for the Eurozone debt crisis is pushing some upward momentum into the market, but it also looks like that a rise in the euro curbed some support as it made the Eurozone wheat more expensive into the dollar-priced export markets. So let's go ahead and go and look at some of the particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at 717 and a half, and it is up 6. March at 732 and a half, up 6. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is trading at 630 and a half, up 5 and a quarter. March at 661 and a quarter, up 5. The May is at 683, up 5. December corn, 645 and three quarters, up 1 and three quarters. March at 654 and three quarters, up 2. May, 660 and three quarters, up 2 and a half. July at 665, up 2 and three quarters. And the September at 620, up 1 and a quarter. November soybeans at 1237 and a half, up, and they're down 13 and a quarter. January's at 12.